Well, good evening. We are going to be in Genesis chapter 45 tonight, and we're kind of carrying on with the story of Joseph, where last week, Joseph, we really talked a lot about him, his brothers coming up to get some food. Joseph recognized them, they didn't recognize him, and he put them through a couple of maybe tests or made them jump through some hoops to find out where their heart is. And at the very end of last week, really, we'll just back up and start there tonight. In the end of chapter 44, what we see is this plea by Judah for the life of Benjamin by offering himself instead. So let's go ahead and start reading Genesis 44, verse 30. It says, "Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servant will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant has become surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please, let your servant remain instead of the lad, a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up to his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me? For fear I will see the evil that would overtake my father." This is really, what you're seeing here is a repentance. Judah was the one who initiated the sale of Joseph to the Ishmaelites, so he'd be carried off and sold into slavery. And when he did that, he was angry and acting out of anger and rage towards his brother, who he hated. When that went away, and his father received the news, it broke his father's heart. And he had to live watching his father go from being this man who fought an angel of the Lord and prevailed until his hip was dislocated, and be renamed the Lord's Fighter. He saw his father stop fighting in a lot of ways. It's kind of an interesting thing that you see there. It broke his heart. And really, you see this, his dad changed. And he had to live with the guilt of that for 22 years. When they finally started getting some bad fortune from Egypt, accusing them of being spies and things like that, the first thing they went to is, this is the blood of our brother being brought back on us now. It's gonna come full circle. And you can see they had guilt. They had remorse. They had seen the wrong they did. And there was no way they could correct it. And so they were feeling this lostness. And one thing Judah decided to do is, I am going to do the right thing next time. And he did. He pleaded for the life of his brother in a very sincere and way. And in verse 4, in chapter 45, verse 1, what you see is it broke Joseph's heart when he saw that repentance. Let's go ahead and start reading now. Genesis chapter 45, starting in verse 1. "Then Joseph could not control himself before those who stood by him, and he cried, 'Have everyone go out from me.' So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'Please come closer to me.' And they came closer, and he said, 'I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here. For God has sent me here to preserve your lives. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and the Lord of all his household and ruler over the land of Egypt." What a powerful statement Joseph says here. Later tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about similarities between Joseph and Jesus. But I can't help but seeing Jesus in this response, where these people who mistreated him so badly, when they came to him with repentance and showing genuine heart change, The reaction Joseph had was, get everyone, get all the Egyptians out of here. And he wept so loudly they could hear him out of the room. Like it just appealed to his heart. And he revealed himself, I'm your brother. It's me. I'm okay. What you did out of anger. And later in the book, it'll say, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And really, he saw that God was working through all that and delivered him into Egypt so he could save them. And now he sees it, and now he realizes that he's acknowledging to them that God is not limited to save by righteousness alone. He used the wickedness of these young men when they sold their brother into slavery in order to create a great deliverance. And isn't that kind of an interesting parallel? What happened with Jesus? God used the wickedness of the people who rejected him and falsely accused him, the wickedness of the Romans preserving themselves and their gross appreciation of watching other people suffer and all those things that they crucified Jesus on the cross. They meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And you really see there's so many parallels in this. It's really impressive in that. But it also is a good lesson for us because we can see how God works in our lives. You know, there's a couple things you can just draw from this. Is when he says in verse 5, now don't be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. There's an aspect of this where you kind of see why are Christians called to forgiveness. And I really think there's a powerful message of forgiveness in this because when you see that God is using mistreatment of you in order to accomplish something good, and then you refuse to forgive, you're kind of making yourself part of the problem. When you can see, okay, God's using this. God was able to create deliverance through this. So I'm not going to hold that against you because it was part of what God intended all along. And you can really see how God can work through us. And even when people mistreat us and we start feeling, instead of feeling resentful, look and see how is God using this. There's another aspect of this I appreciate is you can, when you look back, you know, when you're going through problems, because a lot of what we've been studying, Joseph has been going through problems. So he starts here and he's sold into captivity. Well, what was that experience like? What was it like having your brothers be completely heartless, not hearing your cries for mercy, laughing and joking about it and sending you off into slavery? Then what was it like to arrive and be in some sort of a marketplace on sale and somebody buy you and bring you into their house? You don't even speak the language. And now you're trying to learn how to work and exist in this environment. I don't even know if he was a shepherd. I don't know what he was doing in Potiphar's house. But later we'll find out that herding sheep was an abomination to the Egyptians. So maybe not that. But he was learning how to do those things, trying to learn a new language. That would be scary and frustrating. You're never going to see your parents again, never going to see your brothers betrayed you, all those things. So he's dealing with that pain of that. And then he finally starts to rise a little and he's falsely accused, thrown into jail. You know, when you're going through these experiences, no one ever thinks, hey, this is a good deal. You always think, could it get any worse? Maybe you think, every time I pray, it gets worse. So you start going through these, you start reasoning and I ask God for deliverance, and every time I do, something else happens that's worse than the thing before. And the experience of it is discouraging. You know, I was sold into slavery by my brothers. I was doing right. I didn't. I wasn't immoral, and now I'm in jail. In jail, I'm serving them here now. You could go through that, and you could reason all sorts of things. But when you stop and you look backwards, and you start saying, how did all this come to pass? And there's all these little things. And really, this story is kind of tells all the things that came to pass that made the next step forward in God's plan. And that's what life is like. So many times we go through hard things. So many things in the middle of it, you don't understand it. But once you get past, you do understand it. And you can see how this worked out. You can see how God was with you and protecting you and leading you the whole time. And really, that's what I appreciate about this, is you see Joseph acknowledging that. And when he acknowledges it, he lets go of all the pain connected to it and forgives. He forgives his brother. He feels good about God. He feels blessed in his situation. And he's at peace. And even though he went through such a storm, he's had peace because he trusts in his God. I find that an interesting thing. There's another element I want to go through real quick. Let me look this over. So this is just kind of an interesting quote that kind of brought to mind where just doing the right thing in hard times. This is a quote from Tertullian, who was a Christian writer. He was a fairly prolific writer and preacher back 155 to 200 AD through a persecution. But this was, he was writing what he wrote, and this is from what is his apologetics, what he wrote an explanation to the emperor of Rome about who Christians are and what they did and why they did it. But this is one of his famous parts of this apology he wrote. It says, "But go zealously on, good presidents. You will stand higher with the people if you sacrifice the Christians at their wish. Kill us, torture us, condemn us, grind us to dust. Your injustice is the proof that we are innocent. Therefore, God suffers that we thus suffer. For very lately, in condemning a Christian, a Christian woman to the Leno rather than to the Leo, you made confession that a taint on our purity is considered among us something more terrible than any punishment or any death. Nor does your cruelty, however exquisite, avail you. It is rather a temptation to us. The oftener we are mowed down by you, the more number we grow. The blood of Christians is seed." And what he's saying is, he says, for Christians, the more often you abuse us, that's a temptation to us. Because to suffer for Christ is our glory. And we're drawn to it. So don't stop. You're just proving yourself guilty, and you're proving that a taint to our purity is more offensive to us than dying by any kind of creative torture you can come up for. So let us keep proving that. But I just find this just a fascinating quote, a bold quote of, this was a man who was writing in times when this was happening, and he was tempting them to do more, saying, the more you kill us, the more faithful and the more the church is going to grow. And it's the same sort of thing here. This is what you see with Joseph, is you really see that the hardship he suffered for God cemented his faith and kept him going. And then he looked back and saw the glory of God through what he suffered. And we can do the same thing. That's what I love about the story of Joseph, is it gives such a stark contrast. Jacob lived kind of a questionable life, and he had a lot of hard times, but there was no real redeeming quality to it. And here Joseph, he lives a hard life, and yet he does the right thing. And there's so many redeeming qualities. There's so many signs of peace. There's so many of these things that we can really see in what he did. And so I just find this a very moving statement that Joseph makes, and this total forgiveness. Don't worry about it. God used it for good. So and his brothers were freaking out, right? They couldn't even answer. They're like, oh no, this is very bad. Now it all makes sense. It turns out that our guilt is coming back on us, and yet there's forgiveness. So it's really a tender plea that I appreciate from Joseph. So let's go ahead and start reading now in verse 9. Any thoughts or comments before we move on? All right, let's go ahead and start reading now in chapter 45, verse 9. "Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not delay. You shall live in the land of Goshen. You shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will also provide for you, for there are still 5 years of famine to come, and you and your household and all that you have will be impoverished. Behold, your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth which is speaking to you. Now you must tell my father all of my splendor in Egypt, and all that you have seen, and you must hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. He kissed all his brothers and wept on them. And afterward, his brothers talked to him. Now, when the news was heard that Pharaoh's house, that Joseph's brothers had come, it pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. So here, you just see this reunion where he's loves his brother Benjamin. He's weeping with him. He hugs all his brothers. He kisses them. He greets them. He invites them to live in the best place of his land. He's excited to provide for them. And here again, you start thinking, well, what's it going to be like when I get into heaven? I think something like this. We might go up there and we might feel a little timid, knowing that we haven't always been pure. But we have a brother up there who's going to come and weep on our neck with us. And it's just another picture of the goodness of God. And just another picture of what Jesus, and really just a shadow of Jesus in Joseph, weeping and comforting his brothers and offering of everything that he has. He's like, I'm the king of everything, and you're my guest. You're my family in all this. And it's really, you see another precious thing. And then also, the Pharaoh, the one guy higher than him, is excited to hear, hey, all your brethren are here. That's great. You have my blessings too. And that's what we're going to see next here in verse 17. So let's go ahead and start reading. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this. Load your beast and go to the land of Canaan. Take your father and your households and come to me. And I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you will eat of the fat of the land. Now you are ordered, do this. Take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Do not concern yourselves with your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. Then the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the journey. To each of them he gave changes of garments, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garments. To his father, he sent as follows, 10 donkeys loaded with the best things of Egypt, 10 female donkeys loaded with grain and bread and sustenance for his father on the journey. So he sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, do not quarrel on the journey. Then they went out from Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob. They told him, so here we see Pharaoh provides everything needed, and they just give more. It's interesting to me, in order to bring people back, they're like, don't bring your stuff, but we're going to send gifts, which is kind of an interesting aspect of this. But it's just a showing you're welcome and our joy in bringing you. We're not, your trip is going to be in luxury. And we think about that, riding in a wagon with donkeys loaded with stuff is luxury for them. I feel like we have it a little bit better. We might send a Cadillac or a limousine or something, a nice SUV. They got camels. So, it just is a kind of reminder of our blessing in the luxury we live in. Jim?
I think this also is another foreshadowing of these people being told they're going to a land of promise. They're going to a land of promise. Don't worry about your stuff. You'll be provided. It's just like God says, don't worry about taking this stuff with you. You'll be provided. Have faith. Just trust in God. And if they had just packed up all their stuff, Pharaoh might have been a little annoyed by that. And maybe that was quite important. Like you said, because they didn't have it. And so when we're in that same situation, if we're being offered a land of promise, and we need to have.
Yeah, no, isn't it amazing as you read through this and you think about what Jesus did and what God offers us, how many things just parallel with that? I mean, I saw a list, and I didn't like the list. I think we could have done better. It was 75 ways Joseph and Jesus compare. And some of them were a stretch, I'd have to say. But they didn't bring this up. You know, in this one here, what is in Ephesians 4? It says, when he led captive a host of captives, he sent out gifts. And that's kind of the picture almost, where he's like, just leave everything you have. We're bringing you back into the land that is the blessed land, and you're going to have everything you need for the journey, so you know you don't have to bring stuff. We're sending what you need back so you can have that when you come. And yeah, it's just such a blessing. And you know, you just think about that, is the fellowship and the provision and the plan that worked out from God, and what you need for the journey part of it, and when you get here, you'll be provided for. All those promises. And let's now listen to Jacob's response when he hears this. So let's go and start reading in verse 25. Then they went from Egypt, came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob. They told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and indeed he is a ruler over all the land of Egypt. But he was stunned, for he did not believe them. Why didn't Jacob believe them? Well, it was 22 years ago, so they didn't just get through. But, yeah. Yeah, so he believed a lie. And was there a cost to believing that lie? An emotional cost? Years worth of pain and suffering and all over something that's not true. Now, he had this experience all premised on a lie. And when the truth presented itself, even though it was so much better than the lie, what did he hold on to at first? He held on to the lie. This is an important thing in our own lives. There are sometimes things we believe that aren't true, and yet there is an emotional significance and path in life that's connected to it. And it can be very hard to let it go for the truth. And we all struggle with that to some extent or another. And Jacob struggled with it, but just what if he didn't stop and listen? What if he just said, you guys are just messing with me, you're just lying to me to get me to go, I'm staying in the land of promise, this is where God told me to stay? What would he have missed out on? Everything. There would have been a huge cost. And I just find that interesting, is how many times do you see this? You're raised knowing a lie is the truth, you are connected to it, it has a significant cost to make the change to you, and so it's very hard to make the change. And this is just one of those things where you just kind of see an illustration of something, but it's something that we see happen. And how should the boys, as Jacob is refusing to believe, how should they have dealt with him? I guess we're going without you. Get out of here, you ignorant person. Like, you start, you know, should they have been harsh with him? Should they have been patient with him?
The first thing is that we lied to you the first time. Then in that story, you would have been a little bit more eager to believe this.
I think they did set it. I think they had to. I mean, I'm pretty sure he had some questions. You know, once he kind of, and notice what it says here. So Joseph is still alive, verse 26. And indeed, he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. But he was stunned, for he did not believe them. When they told him all the words of Joseph that he had spoken to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. So stop right there. He didn't believe the narrative that they told him, but he looked at what was happening. And the effective change, the gifts sent, the offering made, was significant enough to alter his belief and to make him think, okay, I'll go. And notice the shift here. Just verse 27, when they told him all the words of Joseph that he had spoken to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent and carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. Then Israel said, what happened to him? His spirit revived, and he started being God's fighter again. And it's just kind of an interesting shift in that narrative where they go straight from calling him Jacob to Israel at this, and when he realizes that God had been working through this the whole time. And it's just, to me, I find that that's a significant change. His name changed. He took on the name that God gave him once again. But this is what happens with us as well. We hear the truth about God, and when we look at the good things of God and believe the promises and begin, I will follow, God gives us a new name. He changes us and makes us something that we weren't before. And I think you really see the power and the shift in Jacob, even in Jacob going back to Israel. Jim?
Yeah, I've heard it said that when the Spirit revived, that's in reference to 26, where he says his heart became numb, where he was stunned, as Jesus says. And so it's just that he, you know, came back to his senses. But I think you're right. I think this is more of a significant revival of his spirit. This is like old Israel back. You know, he had had problems, and he had practically died for a while. And now he had returned to Israel. Because he was no longer, he still had his identity when they started this conversation. He had identity that he was a father with lots of time. And it was hard for him to change that. But by the end of it, he had changed his identity now. He was back in Israel. He still had his son. And he was ready to go.
Yeah.
I was just looking at the common reference there. You know, you said Jacob, when he's coming at Jacob, he's still older. But Israel, God prevails, as it shows the change. I can't even imagine thinking that my son had been dead for all those years and finding out. But in fact, it is Israel, yes, God prevails. It's like, wow, what that must have been for him.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that a fascinating, like, yeah, I just think there's a lot in that shift. But it's also, what does God do for us? You know, all this time he was heartbroken, but he kind of knew some things. You know, he knew that there was this dream that had happened, that everyone was going to be ruling, and he treasured that in his heart. He held on to that information, and maybe he let go of it, maybe he lost hope, but he never quite forgot. And here, he never forgot the name God gave him, and all these things, and now it's starting to be realized. And so Jacob is also revived in this, through God's deliverance. And that's a powerful thing. You know, God delivered him from that suffering he was stuck in, that lie he was stuck in, to know the truth and the power of God's, his deliverance? Or his the power of God prevailing in his life. Jim?
Sorry, one more thing. Right on the same lines as it. With that, Jacob had become Israel a long time ago. And in that regard, he was converted from Jacob to Israel. And then you see this period of time where it parallel to basically fell away from being Israel. And we can see that, you know, we have that problem in our life where we're converted, but then we have a period in our life where we have sin encroached upon us and we fall away to some extent. That we can come back, and we have to accept God's gift and know that God can prevail on our behalf to be able to actually to come back. If Jacob had failed to accept that and failed to give God the credit, then he would have stayed there in Canaan and saved Jacob. But he was willing to give God glory and accept God's gift and return to Canaan.
Yeah. And isn't Isaiah 40 where it says, those who wait upon the Lord? And ultimately, Jacob saw rejuvenation by waiting upon the Lord, and then he saw the Lord's deliverance here. In verse 46, 1. Now, here's another thing. Now, Jacob was struggled, but he didn't lose faith. And one of the ways we know that is, look here in verse 46. It says, so Israel set out with all that he had, came to Beersheba, which would be the southern border of Canaan. He came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. So he stopped, and God told him, you're going to leave the land for a time and you're going to return. But now he's about to leave the land again. Is this okay to do? Is this the right move? In verse 2 it says, God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. He said, I am the God. I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I'll make you a great nation there. I'll go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives and their wagons, which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and their property, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and came to Egypt. Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his grandsons with him, his daughters, his granddaughters, all his descendants he brought with him into Egypt. So here you see him stop, inquire of the Lord, and isn't that a great thing? He's moving down to see Joseph, and God says, your son Joseph is down there. You'll be okay to go. And there's a reassurance from what he heard before. So now we have this genealogical shift in the narrative here. And we'll skip past all of this. And what we're going to... Essentially, it just gives everybody who went down to Egypt with him. It's a list of everybody who went down. Verse 26, it says, all the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. So here you have just an accounting. 70 people went in. How many people came out? Millions. Likely over, I think, 1.5 million, not counting the women and children, I think is what the number in Exodus is. So, yeah, just an extremely large group. They sent Judah ahead to scout the way, to go ahead and prepare the way to the land of Goshen. Verse 29, Joseph prepared his chariot, went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept a long time. Then Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen your faith that you are still alive. Joseph said to his brothers, to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and my father and my household who are in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. When Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? You shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from your youth, even until now, both we and our fathers, and that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. So here is, you know, it's kind of an interesting little piece of information here. Again, a cultural thing. For whatever reason, it's the shepherds, herdsmen, were an abomination to the Egyptians. But here you see Joseph using his wisdom in setting up and getting a result. You know, that's really what he was known for. When he was 30, he's like, we need to prepare for this famine. Here's my proposition. Take one-fifth, and then save it up, and in the famine we'll have enough to get through the famine. And Joseph was just a wise man. Here you see him acting wisely again. You're going to say the right things, so when the Pharaoh asks you, he's going to put you somewhere that is a good piece of property, good for what you're doing, and away from him. Like, you know, whatever, you know, however he's working that out. But he's working in wisdom in order to work these things out here. So in verse 47, then Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brothers. So he tells them, I'm going to jump down a little bit. Verse 2, he took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? So they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers. They said to Pharaoh, we have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father, your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers on the best land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable men among them, then put them in charge of my livestock. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? So Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers have lived during the days of their sojourning. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. What's significant about that? There's a couple significant things, but what are some things that stand out to you in that? Yeah, that's the first thing. Isn't it interesting that Jacob is blessing Pharaoh? King of all the land, but he's the father of Joseph and the promise keeper of God. And Jacob, even though he's 70 people, he's the head of 70 people, and yet he is blessing the Pharaoh of Egypt. And that's a pretty significant statement there. In Hebrews 7:7, it talks about how Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And it says, now it is clear that the greater blesses the lesser. That's clear. And it's the same thing here. It's clear that God had made Jacob even greater than Pharaoh. And another element to this, few and unpleasant have been the years of my life. I'm not going to live as old as my father. It's just been rough. That's true. Why? Why is that his answer?
He's suffered from the loss of his son. He suffered with his brother. I can see how he can look back and think, oh, there have been some unpleasant things. Obviously, there have been blessings too. As humans, I think sometimes we focus on the negative things.
Yeah. Julie?
Yes.
Yeah, no.
So when it says that Jacob blessed Pharaoh, what would Pharaoh receive or get from that blessing?
I don't know.
Oh.
I mean, he would probably ask God to benefit him somehow, to bless his house or to prosper him. And maybe this end of this chapter, we'll see how that blessing was carried out. Because obviously Pharaoh's welcoming his family into his land. And so Jacob is blessing Pharaoh for being that provision. And also, I don't think he forgot the promise God made to Abraham that you're going to be in Egypt for 400 years. And so, that was something that it has been retained. It's not lost to memory. Obviously, we have it in the scripture. So I think that also is something that they would notice. You have a thought, Mike?
Well, to me, it's one of those things because part of their society was if somebody's son did something good for you, you give credit to the son. But who gets most of the credit? The father. And Joseph was definitely, bailed them out. And so Jacob, it's just normal for him to receive the respect from Pharaoh. And I think it's obvious that the blessing is going to be a blessing to God.
I would agree with you on that. He had asked God's blessing upon Pharaoh's house in some form or fashion. The last bit of this chapter, it talks about how Joseph basically enslaved the Egyptian people. It says he collected all the money from the land of Canaan and Egypt 1 year. And when they ran out of money, he collected all the livestock and horses and animals from all people the next year. And when they ran out of that, he bought all the property from all the Egyptians and acquired it for the Pharaoh that year and enslaved all the people to be servants of Pharaoh. What you really see is the first government being established in the way we really understand government to function now, right? We have to pay taxes and all that stuff, and the right to do all that stuff was acquired through them exacting grain from the people and then selling it back to them when they're in need. I just find that's kind of an interesting element to this, but Pharaoh became very powerful through what Joseph did. Can you imagine the extreme wealth of collecting all the money from two whole nations and gathering it into one place? It maybe helps to explain the massive building projects that Egypt had going on. You know, they had a lot of slaves. Everyone was enslaved. They reorganized everyone. And another thing that was wise that Joseph did, though, is he said, okay, you guys all, here's your land, and I own it now, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you seed, and now I get 5% of everything you produce. So he set up a taxing system throughout the whole land. And it's just kind of an interesting element where you see the wisdom of Joseph and how he worked through this 7 years of famine, how God used that to bless him and his family and Pharaoh and all those things, and to exact some power. So there's two things I'd like to end with. We have a few minutes. And I'll let you choose. Would you rather talk about parallels between Joseph and Jesus, or how old were people when things happened? The people in the story here. Both of them are interesting to me. I read something. In fact, this is how it started. I was reading, they were talking about a parallel between Joseph and Jesus. One was that they were both miraculous births, where it said Jacob was 90 years old and Rachel was barren when Joseph was born. And I thought, that seems too old. So I had to go through and figure out, well, how old was he? And so I had to go through and kind of find the verses and put the math together to find out how old he was. And in doing that, I found the rest of the numbers because I highlight green so I can notice it when I get an age or whatever. So I went through and put through all the ages, which is different than I would have expected. But I found it a consistent pattern in all that. So we can talk about that or parallels. I'm going to bring them both up. It's just, what do you want to do tonight is the question. So any preference? The age thing. Okay. Avery chose. We get the age thing. So we'll start right here. Let's begin with Isaac. When Jacob and Esau were born, Isaac was 60 years old. So this just kind of gives us a point of reference, a beginning point. His wife, Rebekah, was barren for a while, but they were born 60 years old. So now, in Genesis 26:34, so Jacob and Esau are the exact same age within minutes, so I have Jacob, but this will give us both timelines. So we'll go back here, let's just say, and this will be our 40-year mark. And so this is 40 years, and Esau gets married. All right, so now we kind of have an idea. There was 40 years old. He married a couple of women that were Canaanites and made Isaac and Rebekah's life miserable. When I have this a little bit out of order. So how old was Jacob when he stole his brother's blessing? Yes. Well, you have to deduce it a little bit. But just what is your impression? What I want to know is if you guys have the same thought I had. How old is Jacob when he stole his brother's blessing? What was that?
20.
He says 20. You say 60. 30-ish. Okay, in the 30s. Okay, he was 75. Okay, here's what messes with me about that a little bit. He's 75 years old. His mom says, Esau's out in the field. Put on some hairy stuff and go lie to your father. He's not a 30-year-old. I mean, I can imagine maybe 30 letting my mom get away with something like that, kind of. But at 75 years old, I feel like I'm going to be a little bit shrewder. My mom, and so anyway, it just that kind of blew my mind a little bit there about being 75 years old. There's another interesting thing about that. So he steals his brother's blessing. His brother wants to murder him. He flees his house and he sleeps on the rock. That's when God calls him. He's 75 years old. It's around the same time period. How old was Abraham when he was called? 75 years. That is Genesis 12:4 says he was 75 years old. So now he's 75 years old. Let's just say it takes a year to get up there, 76, and that's kind of it was like a 500 mile journey or something. So we get up there, 76, and that's the right age if you work backwards. So he's 76. How many years does he work before he gets married? 7 years. What's that put him at? 83 years old when Jacob is Jacob plus Rebecca, right, and Leah and all that stuff. He starts having sons. He owes another 7 years. So in 7 years, the significant thing that happens is Joseph is born. How old is Jacob when Joseph is born? 90 years old. So now he says, I'm going to leave. And Laban says, no, stay. We're going to work a little bit. In Genesis chapter, let me see here real quick. I have so many notes on this. 31, 41. He tells Laban, I worked for you 20 years, 7 years for one daughter, 7 years for another daughter, and 6 years for your flocks. So we know when Jacob fled Laban's house, he was 96 years old. So 96 years old, he becomes Israel. Now, what is significant about that? How did he get the name Israel? What happened right before? Wrestling with an angel all night without quitting at 96 years old. That's pretty significant. Now, Avery brought something out to me. She said it makes sense that he hurt his hip. So that was Avery's comment when I was telling her about how old he was when he wrestled the angel. He said it makes sense when he hurt his hip. So this would put Joseph 6 years old. So when Joseph is carried, starts having his dream and is sold by his brothers, how old is Joseph? 17. So how old does that make Jacob?
107.
Would that be, 107. That was too easy. So we have 107 years old when Joseph goes into Egypt. So we'll just kind of abbreviate there. 107 years old. So that just kind of gives us in our mind a timeline of an age. In this narrative, what you see is Jacob had moved down to Hebron. Was living there. He sent. So, this is the one I wanted to tell you about. Checking my time. If Joseph was 17 when he was sold into captivities, his brothers were born within 7 year period of him. That would have made Judah. Not Judah. Let me find on my notes. Reuben, yeah. Yeah, Reuben would have been 25, Simeon 24, Levi 23, Judah 22. Now, what happened before this is Levi and Simeon killed an entire village of men. Before they were 22. Like, let's say, before they were 20, like 19 and 20, let's say. That is pretty mean, tough characters at that age doing that thing. They were in their early 20s when they sold Joseph into captivity, which would, and it's 22 years later when he sees them again, so they're 47, 46, 45, 44. So that kind of gives you the range of his brothers there. Something else that's interesting in this is from the move from Shechem to Hebron, that's when Rachel dies, so that's when Joseph loses his mom at maybe between 6 and, you know, 6, you know, at a young age, he lost his mom. And then from there, we see Isaac dying. When Isaac dies, Jacob is 120 years old. Isaac is 180 years old. At 120 years old, when Isaac dies, where is Joseph? That's the same year Joseph is made regent in Egypt. Kind of an interesting thing. It happens out of order, but actually the timing puts Jacob at 10 years before he's reunited with his brother or with his son, but it's after Joseph is dead in his eyes. So he loses his wife, he loses his son, he loses his father. Kind of through that period of time, there was a lot of loss. They lose the Rebekah's maid. So you start seeing that 20 years for Jacob. It was a pretty rough 20 years. And anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting that it happens before, but it actually in the timeline, you get Jacob is 120 when his father dies. Joseph is in Egypt becoming king over there. And then when Joseph is 39 years old, when he finally sees his brothers. So that kind of is a 22-year period. And then Jacob is 130, and he lives 17 years in the land of Egypt before he dies in there. So just kind of an interesting thing. I think that timeline, I found it interesting. There's a lot of little, a few more details we could probably bring up, but that's going to be the main thrust of that. I found that interesting. A few things caught my attention. So if Jacob is 75 when he's getting married, it talks about Leah having dim eyes. Maybe it was because she was so old. You know, I mean, really, you just think you always think young, but I mean, it seems like they're pretty old. I mean, that's a long time, a pretty old age to be getting married and to be getting bamboozled by Laban too. You know, I mean. Anyway, just kind of interesting to me is that in my mind, he was about 40 years old when he went up there in his 40s. But when you do the math, he was actually significantly older, which, anyway, it just is interesting to me. I just thought that was kind of interesting. Next week, we'll finish. We'll talk about the similarities between Joseph and Jesus. And if you want a copy of these notes, if you just want to look over them, whatever, I'd be happy to give them to you. But it's just kind of just interesting, you know, just kind of a something to pay attention to. I always like the timelines. It kind of gives you a sense of what happened and when it happened. It also makes you a little bit more disappointed in people. I can see someone at 40 making some mistakes. You know, once you're older than Roger, I think you shouldn't be making those kind of mistakes. So, I don't know. I don't know how old you are, Roger, but you got to be younger than 75. So.
Well, they did live a little bit longer back then, so maybe they're not at 80. They're not like we are at 80 today.
Apparently not.
They're a lot more virile. I would have to say that. I don't think I'm wrestling with an angel all night right now. Jim, you have a thought?
I just said they still have 80 years of experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my thinking. Maybe they just didn't experience as much. You know, watching sheep might be a little bit slower pace of life. I don't know. Anyway, take it for what it's worth. I think it's fun to see the timeline and to kind of get a sense of how old they were, what was happening. And also, to me, I thought it was interesting. Jacob was, I think, when Isaac was born, Abraham was 100 years old and his body was considered dead. So 90 years old is pushing that. And And Benjamin was born at least close to 10 years later, and it killed Rachel. And you wonder, well, why did it kill Rachel? Well, that's probably part of the reason why. She was pretty advanced in age in when she was giving birth to him. And so you just kind of see some of these things. It's just interesting. Helps us to just maybe identify and get a mental image of what's going on here a little bit better. And also, it's information God gave us to know. And so I would have never thought to do that had I not read someone say that he was 90 years old and kind of miraculously born. I was like, okay, I got to see if this is right or not, because that was not what I was thinking. So, any thoughts or comments before we end tonight? All right, if not, let's go to God in the Word of Prayer.